Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and we are officially into the back half of our favorite 100 films of all time. On to number 50. We're in the home stretch as far as I'm concerned. I don't care what anybody tells me. We made it over halfway through, and we did it in about a year. So I'm impressed by both of us. Good start. Fun stuff. Into the best 50 movies, according to both of us. Although I do think that after this whole year of watching movies nonstop and everything like that, we might have a few changes. Tonight we're talking about Seven, the David Fincher movie from 1995, which both of us had on our top 100, and A Single Man, which was from 2009, the Colin Firth movie where he lost to Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart. And yeah, it came out. It was Tom Ford's first film, which I always think is a cool thing. That man needs to make more films. He's made two in 15 years or 13 years, whatever it is. He needs to start making more of those. But two very different movies, two very stylized movies for what they are, one going for beautiful, one going for absolute disgust. John, I have Seven on my list. You had Seven higher. We're going to talk about that one second, but what was your revisit like this time, just briefly?
I had a bit of a new appreciation for Seven this time because we've been exploring like the noir genre a lot more over the last year. And because of that, I really appreciate what Fincher does in Seven a lot more when I watch it now.
Interesting. I think this one drops out of my top 100 and we'll talk about it later. I think it drops out. I have some statements about this movie. I love it. There's no doubt about it. I love this movie. Like, this is, if it's not my top 100, it's still very much a 4-star, one of the best movies of all time. But I had a different reaction to it this time, and I'm curious to hear what we're going to say about that. But first, we're going to start with A Single Man, which was, this was the first time John ever watched it. This, I really believe, if I look at my list, my top 50 movies of all time, really anything from my top 100, I will say that this is the most underappreciated movie in my top 100. Maybe with the exception of Wild Tales, which we will get to much, much later. But Wild Tales built up a bit of a cult following when it first came out because of its Cannes premiere and all of that. A Single Man really built up no following. It came out in a very crowded year, even if that year didn't have the best Oscar nominees. It was a very crowded year. This was the year with The Hurt Locker and Avatar, where they were battling it out at the top, which might not be all that exciting when you think about it. When you start to look at other movies that came out that year, there are a lot of good ones. A Single Man was not nominated for Best Picture, despite the fact that this was the first year that we had 10 nominees thanks to the outrage over 2008 and the Dark Knight and the wrestler getting nothing. And mainly the Dark Knight. I just like to throw the wrestler in because if it was more than five movies, the wrestler would have been nominated for Best Picture. But yeah, this movie pretty much got nothing. It was very little seen. Tom Ford directs it. Matthew Good wasn't really famous yet. You had Julianne Moore and Colin Firth, who were kind of in this weird middle stage. You think about the next year, Julianne Moore does The Kids Are All Right, the same year that Colin Firth goes on to win the Oscar for The King's Speech. Nicholas Hoult was nobody yet. So kind of a weird thing. And Tom Ford takes on his first movie. And this movie to me is just pure perfection. It is gorgeous. The score by Abel Korzelowski. I have no idea. I'm going to butcher it. He's one of the greats, though. He did also the score for Tom Ford's second movie, Nocturnal Animals. Two phenomenal scores. Just absolutely captures everything. The use of color saturation and lighting in this movie is phenomenal and breathtaking and just amazing. The voiceover, Colin Firth's performance is so incredible. Should have won it this year. Jeff Bridges is very good in Crazy Heart, but he should have won it this year and not won it the following year when we had Jesse Eisenberg and Ryan Gosling both going at it. But I think that this is, without a doubt, out of every movie on my top 100, the most underappreciated, one that people really just don't talk about ever. And I don't know, even when Nocturnal Animals came out, people weren't going back and revisiting A Single Man, at least from what I could see. But I remember the first time I watched this movie, it absolutely blew me away. And I've watched it probably about five more times since. And every single time, it absolutely blows me away. It's absolutely devastating. It is a brilliant look at just a gay man going through hardship in the 1960s. And it's just one day. Those movies about one day in somebody's life, man, I'm a sucker for those things. But John, I know you had a very strong reaction to this movie as well, which makes me happy. And I can't wait to hear you just pat me on the back for making you watch it.
I did. I went in, and when it came to A Single Man, I would always confuse A Single Man and A Serious Man.
Mm-hmm. Very easy to do.
Yeah, they came out the same year. They both have A and man around an S word. And I've watched both of them in the last month. And I will tell you, A Single Man is far superior of the films. And I said it to you earlier this week. This is my favorite movie you've had us watch for the podcast so far. Absolutely incredible. It's a film that just so perfectly captures the feeling of loss. And the fact that we're seeing Colin Firth's character on a good day makes it even more impactful.
Yeah, well, this ending, the fact that he finds something to live for and he's come to it, you know, this, see, now I always go back to this. This movie is American Beauty, but from a gay man's point of view. And American Beauty is my, I have it as number two, but that and The Deer Hunter are pretty much interchangeable this time. I just decided to put The Deer Hunter. But I really realized that while watching this movie this time. And, you know, the whole thing with American Beauty is going after the American dream in a straight way and in a straight white male way, which is for some reason why it has gotten so much outrage over these last couple of years, because that movie can no longer be good because it's just about straight white male problems. I think that's a ridiculous take, but I think that what is done in this movie with A Single Man and with Colin Firth's character is this is about a gay white man going through these problems of never really ever being given the chance to achieve what most people consider the American dream. All of these views of the normal family across the street, Julianne Moore talking to him about it. We could have had something normal, but getting into this whole thing with his love life and his relationships and how he feels whole. And then we sit down and we watch him come to terms with it. And at the end of American Beauty, you have Kevin Spacey sitting at the table. I'll say Lester Burnham so people don't get triggered. We have Lester Burnham sitting at the table and you just see the gun come in the frame. And he says, I'm great. And it ends, or it doesn't end, but it goes into that. And then in this movie, it's that smile, that realization of like, everything is going to be okay. And then he dies and it gets you at that moment. And I think it's just, it's so devastating, but it doesn't feel cheap because we watch the character go through the arc that was necessary. And at the end of the day, we know that his life was not going to continue to be that happy. So while it's a very depressing ending, because he does die while he's in a happy state, we also know that if he would have lived for another year, he's going to have more bad days than good days. They're not all going to be like this. He's going to have to constantly remind himself. And it's that character arc and that devastation of, oh, we just finally saw him come to terms with everything, and now he dies. But living in 1960s as a gay man, it didn't matter if you came to terms with everything. Yep. Everybody else had to come to terms with everything. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. It's poetic the entire time. And John, I'll let you hop in here since this was your first experience with it. But man, that ending every time, woof.
The ending so devastating, but the way that Tom Ford bookends the film with Matthew Good coming in for the kiss on Colin Firth on his dead body at the end, it's so beautiful and so impactful because it really does give us that cyclical feel of the film, mm-hmm. in which it feels so complete because of it.
Yeah,
because the phone call that he gets at the beginning of the film is just it hurts because you know he's just learning of the death of the most important person in his entire world, but at the same time he's also being told, yeah, but nobody wanted to tell you.
Yeah.
And, like, he still is getting this, despite the fact that was with Jim for 16 years, because of the time period, because of how unaccepting everyone was, Jim's family didn't want to tell him.
Yeah.
They don't want him at the funeral. Like, he doesn't even get a chance to say goodbye. And that's what I think is so beautiful about the ending of this film, because that is... rather than him saying goodbye, it's Jim welcoming him.
Yeah. Where there's now going to be there's no judgment. It's just, we're dead, mm-hmm. and this is, you know, we're together now. The part about that call, and I'm one of those people, whenever I watch a movie, when people go, when animals die, like I always think about the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the cat gets like all gutted and stuff, and everybody's like, but then there's like rape and all this craziness throughout the entire movie, mm-hmm. and everybody's like eating their popcorn. That always really disturbs me. I think that shows like a weird, weird quirk of humankind. But in this movie, in that phone call, when he asks, what about the second dog? And they can't give him even an answer on that. It's just so brutal. It's just absolutely devastating. And so, but again, going to this phone call, which Armie Hammer is the voice here. Perfectly played just for the voice here. But it's such a hard scene to watch. And Colin Firth just nails it as George losing his mind, waiting for that phone call. And we see the excitement when he answers it, only to have this devastation. And then didn't just happen. This has been a couple days now, or it was the day before, whatever it was. And we don't think you should come and see him. And now you have to continue to live like that without feeling whole and without ever being able to actually give your goodbye. While you're looking around you and seeing all these whole complete people, I love what he does with the family across the street, especially since, I mean, I know with you being in Canada, you might not necessarily hit so heavily on this like white picket fence bullshit of like 1960s America, which I think we talked about. What movie were we talking about where it was such an American movie with all of that stuff? And you were just like, yeah, whatever. I forget what it was, but it doesn't matter. I can't remember. It was one of the movies that we watched on here. I'll think of it at some point. Oh, it was The Hours. And I think that was the part where you were just like, whatever, but you liked that movie. I think that this whole white picket fence thing and this family, and but you can tell that there's something off about them. There's still something off. But this is what it was. The boy who's just out of control, running around at the neighbor's house, dressed up like an Indian, shooting people with arrows. The little girl who's just like kind of neglected and kind of on her own and curious about things in the world. And to show that, and the slow motion on all of that, and the music, and how it's like him realizing, I could have had this if I was, and I'm using air quotes for anybody listening, normal. If I was normal, I could have had all of this, and instead I got none of it, and instead I'm alone living in this house and I have nobody to share anything with. And it's almost like he's thinking to himself, is this worth it? Did I make the right decisions? When they go into the school, and Nicholas Holt's character sitting there next to the girl with the big poofy blonde hair, and he's thinking that these two are together, like, is it worth it? Could that have been something that I could have had? Is this what, this is what's attractive in America, the blonde with the cigarette and the big eyes and all that. And, you know, we're fearful because we're hidden. We can hide in plain sight. And then there's the two gay guys who are sitting next to each other, right next to him. It's almost like he's wondering, what did I give up? Was it worth it for these 16 years? And all of those slow motion realizations and how it builds to the Nicholas Holt ones near the end of the movie. It's just brilliant filmmaking. And it's funny how this movie really didn't get credit for that. It got all the credit for Colin Firth's performance and Julianne Moore's performance in a very small role, but it didn't get the credit for the actual filmmaking and craft that went into this.
One of the most beautiful things about that opening, or that first sequence where we see the family next door, is you don't realize it's just the family next door at first. And I think that's so, because I'm watching this movie, and at that point, you're still not 100% sure of what time period this movie is taking place. There hasn't been any like major hints to tell you exactly the year that it's happening. So you're like, oh, is this like a flashback or something? Like, what's going on here? And then you realize it's just him peeping through the window in his washroom and like washing this nuclear family and the way that they're reacting and everything. And it's just so beautifully framed by Tom Ford, because it leaves that option. It's like, and as you go into the movie further, you start realizing this is questioning. This isn't him longing for a period of time that's long gone. This is him wondering, did he give up on something that would have actually made him happy?
Yeah. And I agree with you, like the decision to not really let us know who that family is right away, but how they keep appearing. One of my favorite scenes, it's probably one of my favorite shots ever. You know, I say that a lot on this podcast, but you know, we do a top 100 movies. Think about a top 100 shots where he's in the bank and the little girl walks up and it's shot from above and we see her reflection and her, and then the slow motion pan just up with the lighting and the saturation and the detail of the fact that this little girl who's probably like 8-9 years old with the leg hairs and all of that, like just so innocent and young and everything. And him kind of seeing this as like a, you know, like just like a pure happiness, a pure curiosity and him looking at that. And then her just kind of staring at him and just being like, you look sad or something, like it's just so, do you want to meet Charlton Heston, her scorpion? Like, I love that moment. I love that shot. I just think it's so different. We don't see things like that all the time in movies. This movie obviously pulls a lot from it. John, I don't know if you've seen it, but In the Mood for Love, which is a movie the first time I saw it, I thought was one of the biggest steaming piles of crap ever. And I still think it's incredibly overrated, but it is a very good movie. It's just not as good as everybody makes it seem, at least in my estimation. But that's a movie where there is slow motion after slow motion after slow motion, and with the music and all that, because there is like this hopefulness and like there's this desire and this like this wishing, this longing for something that he does not have. And then even Jennifer Goodwin comes over. It is Jennifer Goodwin who plays the role, I believe, but comes over and asks, do you want to come over for whatever? No, that's all right. I have plans tonight. And he's going to go hang out with another very, very lonely person who doesn't have any of that either, who had it and lost it. And now like, they're just together and it's like, why didn't we do this together? And like, he says, her, are you happy? Your son doesn't even talk to you. Your husband left you. Like, you're not happy either. But I love how it all builds from these slow motion moments. And then he's driving by and he's doing the finger guns at the kid. Like all of those little things, like he's messing around because he has that personality to be a great father. And yet in this time period, he never, ever got that chance.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about the fact that like this movie gets praised for Colin Firth's performance, and rightfully so. I mean, from the moment Colin Firth starts speaking at the beginning of this movie, like you're completely in on his character of George, and like it's devastating. I texted Phil within the first 10 minutes of this movie asking him how you don't cry while watching this movie, because it's so devastating. Just like hearing the pain in his voice as he's describing how hard it is to wake up. And then you find out why it's hard. And then there's the scene where George goes to Charlie after finding out about Jim's death. And it's just the sound of rain as he's relentlessly sobbing. It's such a beautiful shot. And you don't need to hear it because it's just eliciting this internal response from you to, that you know exactly, like this visceral response as to what's going on, that you don't need to hear it because it's more impactful not hearing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then later on in the movie, when he goes to her house and he is happy, he still has that flashback of like the same moment going in there and why he's so reluctant to go there, why he was planning to kill himself instead of going there in the first place, why he was going to do that beforehand. And, you know, his decision after that, though, like, I'm going to go back to the bar where I met him. And, and, you know, kind of just coming through all this. I mean, there's nothing. See, what I think is so amazing about this movie is there's nothing particularly exciting that happens in this movie.
No.
It is a lot of conversations. It's a lot of slow motion. It's a lot of really pretty shots, but there's nothing particularly exciting. But the use of the flashback when the flashback is inserted, the use of the slow motion when the slow motion is inserted, the use of the different characters and the longer moments. If you notice, the score almost completely cuts out for the third act until he does die. All of these decisions make it add up to feel like something massively profound, which I do think it is, but it also makes it add up to feel like it's something much more exciting than really what the sum of the parts are. And it takes the mundanity of a one day in a normal person's life. I mean, you have to think about this. This is a brilliant character study of this type of character. And there's probably what, a million people in America going to do this every day, whether they're gay, straight, whatever it is, but losing a loved one and now having to wake up a year later and still go through the motions and contemplate, am I going to kill myself today? Is this what's going to happen? And none of this is necessarily special or unique. And this character himself isn't really special or unique. Like he's a professor. That's it. He's a professor going through a really bad day, but you know, the flashbacks come in where they're sitting there, change the record, and the flashback to him with Charlie, and the flashback to him getting the phone call, and the flashback to him meeting Matthew Good, and how it parallels and also contradicts a lot of what he's feeling in those moments when he's like, I'm just going to take my beer and cigarettes to leave or whatever it is. And then Nicholas Hoult comes walking in, forget that, two scotches. We're going to sit here.
Yeah.
Like this idea of, I'm going to get back on this horse. I'm going to go back and I'm going to start living my life again. And I'm going to get back out there. And he does. He starts to live his life again just in time for it all to be pulled out from under him. It's that American dream tragedy type thing. And like I said, it's what makes this movie great and why American Beauty, what I think is a very similar movie, is always up there in the top for me. Because it's looking at the family across the street. They're so similar. Yeah. It's just one is looking at the family across the street. One is looking at the family or looking at the weird guy next door. You think American Beauty delves very heavily into what it's like being a gay person in America, especially in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's the use of the contrast that Tom Ford is using throughout the flashbacks and the slow motion and everything. It's that contrast that really helps drive this film, I feel. Mm-hmm. Because the emotion packed in, if you kept this film as utterly depressing as it really is the entire time, we'd be miserable. Yeah. I mean, you and I probably wouldn't be miserable. We probably love that. But most people watching this movie would be pretty miserable. But it's those moments of contrast that really get you thinking more about what the film's going through. And it's how you realize that George is having a good day. Yes, it tells you right at the beginning, today's going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when you see how much pain he's going through despite it being a good day. And like for anyone who has experienced loss, it's just going to speak miles more to you because of how impactful that is, because every day is that. It's trying to get through the day and not have your mind wander back to the things that remind you of what you've lost.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a masterful look at like depression and all and mourning and I like all the discussions. Like I love the teacher scene. So many times like a teacher like preaching to a class can be so boring, but I love the way that this one is done. I think it's fascinating, the zoning out while other answers are being given and the thinking about other things and You know, that I love the just conversation between him and Charlie. They have so much in common, yet they have so little in common. They don't really know how to connect with each other all the way anymore, despite the fact that they're really all that each other have. And I love that those conversations like are long and drawn out. I love that Nicholas Holt continuously calls him sir, almost in a flirtatious way, but also in a respectful way, because it's just unrelenting. It's never ending. Like he's living through this where he is the old man. Everybody calls him the old man. And now you have this guy who's calling you sir as he's hitting on you. And you, what do you do? And there's also this interesting conflict of a teacher student relationship that is going on here. And that's a weird dynamic, but so much of it never handles anything with kid gloves, but it still makes it so that you understand where every character in this movie is coming from, when they're coming from it, because it takes its time and it's not just trying to bounce around too quickly through everything.
Yeah. I mean, we all know my love for slow cinema and like the long buildup of things. And while A Single Man is not slow cinema by any means, it does kind of hold a lot of the tenets of it where it takes its time with every scene. It's not so much that this is a long movie that's overdrawn like most long cinema. This is only just over an hour and a half long.
Yeah.
But each scene is so drawn out and thought-provoking because of the way that it's presented, where it is presented like a conversation. We're not getting those the awkward pauses and the moments in between taken out like we do in film sometimes. It's just real conversation with real emotion attached to it. And that in conjunction with Tom Ford's like decision for like the saturation of the color palette and how we get those flashes of like the red seeping in at times, or like the color as George is talking to Carlos. And it gives the whole film this ethereal feel to it, where it's almost so real that it can't be anything other than a dream.
And that's what I totally forgot about the Carlos scene. And I thought that was such a great scene, the whole James Dean thing and what are you doing? And the way they put it against the Psycho backdrop, I just think that's beautiful. But you're right. It does feel like this movie, you know, the entire time he's dead and he's almost like reliving that last day over and over again, because it is too dreamlike. And it's the same thing again. I keep going back to this, but I can't help it, especially after watching it this time. I realized why I love this movie so much. But in American Beauty, we have all of those flashes with the red roses and them coming out of weird things and pulling them out of his mouth and pulling them out of Mina Suvari's mouth, them coming out of Mina Suvari's shirt, like whatever it is. And you say to yourself, why is this happening? I don't understand. Because it's a death dream. You know, that's just what it is. And A Single Man very much has that feeling of like, what is he noticing on this last day? He's noticing the colors on the different people. He's noticing all those little moments that you take for granted every single day, that, you know, you might read something in the end, the last line will be like, you know, take a good look around, kid, one day it'll all be over. And you say, oh, okay, I'm going to start taking things in. And then in the regular hubbub of a year, of a life, of whatever, you can't possibly take it all in, and you take things for granted and you rush through things. And there's days where you just say, screw this, I just want it to be over and I want to go to bed. But in this movie, it's what is he taking a look at on this last day of his life? What is he really looking at? And almost everything that he is focusing on is something super mundane that you see every single day. You see kids playing on a lawn every single day. You see, you know, different lighting on people's faces every single day. Like, this is all the time, but it's drawing attention to these moments of beauty, the girl smoking the cigarette in there and the eyes. And I love the color saturation with the eyes. It's just beautiful. But that's, you know, those are the things at the end of the day, that's what poets write about. You know what I mean? That's what people always talk about. Those are the beautiful moments that people are always trying to capture that they can't quite capture, because it's so much harder to explain why that's beautiful and why that's interesting than something like Seven, which just automatically will pull you in because it's a murder mystery. Like, it's so difficult to do. And it's wild to think that this was Tom Ford's first movie. But it's also so understandable that only a designer of clothing would be able to make a movie look this good, despite the content not being all that much.
Yeah, I agree. It is honestly one of the most beautiful movies I've ever watched. Yeah. It's just every single, like, I've talked a lot about like picturesque movies, and this isn't picturesque, I wouldn't say. It doesn't have those moments where it's like, okay, this is like a portrait, but it's just the melding of colors in the palette just really draw you in for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Despite being muted a lot of the time, despite being kind of like just like different and saturated, it's just pulling you in the entire time because it feels more like, yes, it feels dreamlike, but it also feels more like real life at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to explain if you haven't seen the film.
Yeah, I agree. So watch it. That's my last bit of advice on A Single Man. Just watch it. This is a movie I try to tell people all the time. This is one of those movies where too, like, every time I sit down to watch it, I'm like, am I going to like this less now? Like, is this going to wear off? Because a lot of times, like, movies, critics are always wrong. People are always wrong. But there's still some movies where you're like, oh, that one just hit me at a good time in my life. And now it's not hitting me at that same moment anymore. And maybe the other people who didn't, you know, give it that credit or why it wasn't nominated or whatever it was. But this is one every time that just continuously wows me. There's never been a time where I've sat down and watched this movie and been like, eh, that didn't quite hit. I mean, there's like some of my movies in my top five. You watch them on the wrong day, you're like, ah, it didn't hit me the way it normally does. Then you watch it the next time, you just cry your eyes out. But this movie so far, there hasn't been one time where I'm like, eh, whatever. It's good stuff. It's good stuff.
It is.
And go ahead.
I don't even remember what I was going to say. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I'll just wrap it up with this. The Blind Side was nominated for Best Picture over this movie. So I just want to say that The Blind Side was nominated for Best Picture over this movie. District 9 was as well, which I know they're not.
We already talked really about that movie.
Yeah. District 9, The Blind Side, and Education, which is actually a pretty good movie, but still like not like this level. We're all nominated over this movie. It's a very weird year. And when you start to look at some of the movies that came out that year, you go, why were so many good things not nominated for Best Picture? You know, that was when you had In the Loop, The White Ribbon, great movie. Just a lot of good movies that just weren't, that just didn't make the cut somehow.
Yeah, it was definitely a year where the focus was more on like mainstream films than anything else.
Because of what happened with The Dark Knight. Because of what happened,
yeah.
It was coming on the heels of that, and that's why there was so much attention drawn to these movies.
Yeah, so that's why when you look at like the nominations, you have things like Avatar and The Hurt Locker and District 9. These were big box office pulls that were exciting movies. People weren't looking for these emotional character dramas that year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we still haven't even gotten to my favorite movie from 2009, which for me is for you have The Road, but for me it's A Secret in Their Eyes. So we have plenty of 2009 movies. That's what I'm talking about. A lot of really good movies. But yeah, they were trying to make it hip to watch the Oscars because the year before they totally butchered it by nominating movies like The Reader and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which might be David Fincher's worst movie if you just don't count Alien 3 as a David Fincher movie. But before we jump into that, let's talk about our favorite movie we watched from this past week. I only watched one and I literally watched it right before this podcast. I watched Life is Beautiful. Not as good as I remember it being. Still a very good movie. Roberto Benigni is great. It's definitely an interesting look at like a concentration camp and the Holocaust and all that. It's kind of corny though, especially in the beginning. And I understand like that's kind of like what the movie's supposed to be. It's supposed to be kind of putting kid gloves on the Holocaust. But it's to its detriment sometimes. I think it's really, really great when it's really, really great. Like it packs the emotional punch, especially the ending, just with the wide open spaces and everything. It's beautiful. But there's a bit of it that's just a little bit too clowny. I understand that it's being told from the kid's point of view. So how does he view his father and all that fun stuff? But I think it is a bit detrimental to its success more sometimes. And I gave it 3 stars. It was the only thing I watched this week, though. Probably be watching a lot more, not maybe this week, but the week after, because Oscar nominations come out on February 8th and I have to catch up on everything. So John and I can give Patreon content to anybody who's interested in that.
Yeah, and I also only watched one other movie this week. I watched Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon, which, of course, is a classic film, not just of the samurai genre, but a film in general. It was my first time watching it, and I went in kind of knowing like the premise of it. Obviously, I know about like the Rashomon effect and everything, but I didn't quite know what to expect. Of course, Like, Toshiro Mifune is incredible, as he always is in every Akira Kurosawa film he does. But it's really interesting seeing that, like, the Rashomon effect is more not just, like, the three separate tellings of the same story, or the four separate tellings of the same story, but it's also the retelling of those stories.
Yeah.
And just how Akira Kurosawa is able to make these three, tell the same story four times and still make it incredibly engaging for the entire movie's run. It's fascinating. If you haven't given it a watch, give it a watch. It's on Canopy, so it's easily accessible for everyone.
Yeah, I haven't watched it in about 12 years. It's been a long time. I watched it right at the end of high school, right at the beginning of college. I liked it. I didn't love it, but I also think that was, like, based on hype. And again, I'm not really, like, that big of a fan of Japanese cinema. Although, like, you know, I haven't seen that much of it, but some of that is because I just haven't been that big of a fan. But definitely one I want to watch again. But yeah, the whole Rashomon thing, I always think about one of the best uses of this in recent movies or TV was The Affair, at least the first season of The Affair, where it was told from the different points of view, and you would get it from one point of view and then you get it from the other point of view and things would just be different. It's beautiful when things like that happen. I love that stuff. I think that's just great. And yeah, Kurosawa really did kind of define that genre. So Rashomon's definitely something worth watching. If you haven't seen it, you live under a rock if you're a cinephile, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about Seven, which, John, is your number 50. I had it all the way back, I want to say at 84 or 83, something like that. So it was pretty far down for me in this top 100, but still in my top 100. But let's hear why you start off your top half here with this movie.
So I will say it probably falls back based on, like, things that I've seen since making the list for the top 100. Mm-hmm. But what I really appreciate with David Fincher's Seven, especially watching it back to back with The Silence of the Lambs, is you really see what Fincher's going with this, like, reintroduction to the noir genre in the 90s. Because what we have now, especially with our characters of Mills and Somerset, you have Somerset is essentially your prototypical suave noir protagonist. He's calm, he's collected, he knows what he's doing. He, for some reason, has the necessary information to piece things together. And then you have Mills, who's like this very, like, more like this 80s, 90s cop character who's a bit far too rash, a lot, like, elevated, ready to go for violence and everything. And I think that's really what I think draws me to Seven. Because whereas, like, Seven's kind of like that interesting thing that everyone kind of gets, like, interested in the seven sins and that aspect of it for a little while, and that's kind of why you watch the film in the first place. When you're more appreciating of the characters of Mills and Somerset, I think that's when the film starts elevating above other, like, neo-noirs of the period.
Yeah, I really, like, again, I love this movie. It's in my top 100, at least as of now. I do agree with you. I think what brings this one up is the fact that they have two really great cop characters. We don't see this super often. And normally, like, when this does happen, they're so opposites just for the sake of being opposites that it doesn't work a lot of the time. Like, you got the by the book partner, and then you got the hard nosed it the dirty way partner. And with Mills in this movie, he's not trying to go against the book. He's just trying to prove himself. And I think that's why this dynamic works so well, because it's about somebody trying to prove himself and somebody who literally doesn't care anymore and just wants to retire and be left alone, and how they go against each other, and how you have Mills, who's young, married, moving into this place, and Somerset, who's old, divorced, and getting away from this place, and trying as hard as he can to get out of this place. I also think it's fascinating. We have a tendency, just as human beings in general, to always assume we're living through the worst times. I think that social media has very much amplified these feelings of dread and the worst of the worst. But it's funny that a lot of the stuff that they're talking about in 1995 is still the same thing being talked about now. And even though this is a work of fiction, people don't create works of fiction based off of things that have never happened or that couldn't be experienced, or even in science fiction. It's always based off of some sort of reality. And so I think with this, it being based off of that, like the city's falling apart. To me, this is very much New York. You know, New York was just falling apart during this time period. And it really was like in the 2000s where it started to build back up again, mainly because of, I don't want to say mainly, but there was a huge coming together after 9/11 and like a city on the rise and all of that. And, you know, we hear about it all the time in America, the Chicago shootings and the Baltimore shootings and the Washington DC shootings. Like cities are, you know, not necessarily the places that you want to be all the time. And this is such an overblown version of that with two very different perspectives on it. Somebody just moved into it with his young wife and is going to start his life there. And then somebody else who is just like, man, you couldn't have made a worse decision in your life. That really elevates it. But obviously what sets this one apart from others of the genre is the style of this and the murders that take place throughout the movie, being that they're based on the Seven Sins. I think that's what really sets this one apart. And I also think that's probably what's going to drop it out of my top 100, is because while it's one of those, you know, movies that is just, you know, it's in there, it's gritty, it's grimy, it's disgusting, sloth and gluttony. Like all these moments are absolutely devastating. I love how the dialogue is very sparse. It just gets to the point, whatever. It is one of those things where once the Seven Deadly Sins type thing is like revealed, it does lose it to me a lot of like it's what makes it special. And when you watch it, it's kind of like The Usual Suspects. I think that movie's great, even knowing the twist at the end. But if you want, if some people, they'll watch that movie and be like, well, once you know the twist, the rest of the movie doesn't really hold up. That happens a lot with movies with twist endings. And I think with Seven, well, again, 4-star movie without a doubt, it's one of those where once you start to put all this together, does it really feel like it has the same impact, or is it really just this wow of an ending and the reveal of Kevin Spacey that's coming on the tail end of just something that is really, really stylized, and that's what makes it really, really good. Still a brilliantly put together movie, but I do think that it ultimately drops out of my top 100 after this viewing.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, that wouldn't surprise me at all. It's, I think, this movie, I think a lot of people put as like Fincher's best movie, and obviously I have two more Fincher movies above it that most people won't put above it when they're ranking their Fincher movies.
I mean, I put Social Network above it too, so we're on the same page, at least with that one.
Yeah. But I think what a lot of it comes down to is Seven is a very accessible Fincher movie for a lot of people, which seems weird because it's this very like gratuitous violence, and like we see it, it's a very visceral movie. But I think it's just easier to like comprehend exactly what Fincher is going for in this film than in some of his, like, if we look at like his other noir-esque films, like Zodiac, it's handled in a much more accessible way than that movie is. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that when you think of Seven, you're always thinking of the darkness of Seven. You think it's a very dark movie. And that was one thing I really noticed watching it this time, is that it's not a very dark movie at all.
From there's just certain scenes. It really is the gluttony scene, which stands out as being so dark. It's a very rainy movie, that's for sure.
It is.
But other than the gluttony scene, it's really not that dark of a movie. You're right.
No, and I think those contrasts really help propel it. And it's funny, like, watching the beginning of Seven and having like a Nine Inch Nails song play for the opening title sequence. And just knowing how Fincher and Reznor are going to be inseparable in a decade. But it's that light, it's that contrast in light and dark. It really gives you that underbelly of this city, this unnamed city, which I also think is incredibly important, that they're not saying this is any specific city, because it has like elements of all the major cities of America, it feels.
Yep.
And then when it's all kind of brought together in these, at the tail end of this film, in this like desert, which makes it like a lot of the film makes it seem like we're in New York, and then like you get this desert and you're like, okay, is this LA then? But it brings it all together. And what Fincher's really done in constructing this movie is he's taken more, it's less a full film and more small vignettes put together, in my opinion.
You're almost looking forward to what's the next murder going to be. And I think that's what's so amazing about this movie, is that it's so interesting to see him create a movie that is despicable, and we see gluttony, and it's horrifying. But then he dips into that part of human, you know, whatever you want to call it, psyche, that makes you say, what's going to be next? What are they going to do for pride? Mm-hmm. What are they going to do for envy? What are they going to do for wrath? Like, you start asking that, and it's sick and it's messed up, but those are the questions you're asking. You're wanting to know, what am I going to see next? And he tops it pretty much every time. I mean, the whole pound of flesh thing is interesting. Obviously, lust is probably the most memorable one other than gluttony. Sloth, you don't really know how the guy dies, but that one is probably one of the most terrifying jump scares in movie history. Every time I jump through the ceiling, that part is crazy. But when you see this, you're like, oh, how's he going to top that one? How's he going to top that one? How's he going to top that one? And he really does top it at the end with Brad Pitt and Kevin Spacey and What's in the Box and Morgan Freeman. I mean, What's in the Box has just become iconic. Anything that says What's in the Box, and they're just saying in passing, somebody's going to scream What's in the Box at the top of their lungs, or somebody's going to say Gwyneth Paltrow's head. Like, somebody is going to say something like that. But we are looking forward to it when we really shouldn't be. But that's what he's saying with, like, these movies that were coming out in the early 90s, like Silence of the Lambs and stuff. It's getting into, like, that kind of perverse reaction of humanity to be like, I want to see something really messed up. I want this to be messed up. Why are we rooting for stuff to be really messed up? And he's just diving into that in this movie that is just so gross throughout, with the vomit and the blood and the fingernails and the clippings. And here's his stomach. Always love Reggie Cathy in this, that he's got such a small role, but I always love him being like, yeah, here's his stomach. And it's just disgusting. There's just a lot of really, really, really interesting little things that Fincher is doing that you might not even notice as you're watching this movie, which is also what makes it such a compelling watch. And you know, I'm not surprised a lot of people consider this his best. When you really start to look at Fincher movies, Fincher is one of the great directors of this generation, but he's also he's become very polarizing. His movies don't make a lot of money. That's just a fact. And then, you know, you have movies like Fight Club and Seven, which, you know, were like this kind of like gritty, you know, neo-noir type thing, even though, you know, Fight Club is whatever it is. But, you know, they're really like that, very dark and brooding. And then you have like Curious Case of Benjamin Button, where it's like, what is this movie? Like, what are you doing? Like, what is this? And, you know, Gone Girl and Zodiac, like, they're very polarizing movies. They'll get really good reviews, but they're still polarizing. I think that Seven is probably kind of like we talked about the Silence of the Lambs last week. It's just accessible because everybody can have that same reaction to it. It's like, oh my God, like, nobody's walking in this movie going, wow, I'm so happy I watched that fat guy sit in that chair. Like, that was so attractive. But because it's like so conversational, everybody can get something from it and everybody can have a discussion about this movie and feel the same way. And I think that's what makes it almost universal, and especially in its acclaim.
Yeah, and I think, like, we can't underestimate the impact the cultural zeitgeist has on films like this, especially in the 90s, where, I mean, these 90s Fincher films, Seven and Fight Club, are both just, like, this part of the cultural zeitgeist, and it's, you're a teenage boy, someone's going to say, hey, have you seen Seven?
Yeah.
Like, have you seen Seven yet? It's just one of those things that, for some reason, it attracts an audience, and I think the fact that it has like those religious undertones to it makes it a little more accessible for a lot of people too, because like it's more relatable then, right? It's not like Zodiac, where it's like, here's this unsolved murder, we don't know why he's killing these people. It's, oh, there's a cause for these murders. It's almost acceptable because you know he's killing them because of these sins. And there's a lot of criticism levied to like the ending of this film sometimes, where it's like, okay, but like, how did John Doe like decide that Mills was going to be Wrath and he was going to be Envy when he'd been planning this for at least a year? Yeah. Even though there's clearly a line in the movie that says, I decided I have to change my plans.
Yeah. That literally is said. That's not a concern at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, but it's those little things that Fincher does, and he makes it so that the murders are almost second in this film, I feel. And that's what I really felt this time watching it, is that, like, yes, when you first watch Seven, the thing you're talking about is all these different murders and how these people are killed. But the more times you watch it, you're not looking at that. The more times you watch it, you're looking at like that Mills-Somerset interaction. The fact that this film starts with Mills and Somerset meeting for the first time on a case is it's fascinating because it's there's not a lot of interaction between the two characters, yet you know everything you need to know about these two characters in that first 2 minute scene of the movie.
Yeah, him sending him out.
Yeah.
And you know what else I think really worked with this movie? And it's not just the seven deadly sins and stuff like that. And it's not just the style. It's the fact that they ended up getting who was going to become an incredibly famous actor who wasn't at the time. I mean, I'm gonna look up real quick because I mean, I loved Spacey just as an actor.
Yeah.
Was this just after The Usual Suspects or was the same? It was like the same year. I'm trying to see which one technically was 94. They were both 95. So The Usual Suspects technically came out before Seven. Kevin Spacey had been in Glengarry Glen Ross. He'd been in Swimming with the Sharks. So it wasn't like he was an unknown. Like Kevin Spacey was definitely a known at this time. But it wasn't like he had like The Usual Suspects and Seven coming out in the same year really elevates this movie for like the fact that he was their murderer, because now people are going to more easily recognize him. The fact that he's not in the credits, at least at the beginning, he's not in the credits until the end credits. He takes this essentially as an uncredited role so that it can be hidden. Normally, when you're watching a mystery movie, you're looking for who the murderer is going to be amongst the people who are already in the movie. At the beginning of this movie, they give you all of the opening credits. I mean, we get that whole entire, like you said, the opening credits montage. And so you're assuming maybe John C. McGinley's the murderer. Maybe it's Brad Pitt doing it, or maybe it's more like, who knows? But you're feeling like it has to be one of them. And that's why that scene when Kevin Spacey comes walking up to the courthouse, you're like, what the hell just happened? Because you don't see that coming and there's no way to see it coming. And I think that's also what elevated this for a lot of people, because it was like, you're never going to know who did it. And you could literally sit there and say, you're never going to know who did it. And it came out the same year that Kevin Spacey literally was in maybe the greatest twist ending of all time.
Yeah.
So it just happened to be that they were both in the same exact year. And I think that's what kind of led to the legacy of Seven was, oh my God, like you're never going to see this one coming. And if you sit with somebody with The Usual Suspects, they'll sit there and try to figure it out the entire movie. They'll make 500 guesses until they guess correctly. You can't guess Seven correctly. That's what's fascinating about it.
Yeah, and that's what Fincher does to evolve the noir, I feel, because we don't have these like these skeezy background characters. We don't have like, you know, the informants and like the skeezy mob characters that we have in like other noir films. Mm-hmm. What we have here is we just have two very different detectives with very different ways of approaching things. I love the montage of Somerset going to the library and just like reading through all these books while box playing. And then you have Mills like grabbing like the cliff notes of all of these books to like try to figure it out. And it's like, you know, it's not as effective, but it's like this idea of like this younger, impatient generation, which is fascinating because, you know, it's the ever going conversation you have about generations where the preceding generation always feels the other one is more impatient and more wanting that instant fulfillment. And it's really interesting looking at this 25 years later and seeing that it's the exact same conversation that we are having today when it comes to these type of things. And it's that contrast in those characters and the fact that they're the only ones we really know the names of the entire movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love that they just keep Kevin Spacey as John Doe. We don't ever get any other type of thing. It's just John Doe. He's John Doe. And like that is crazy. They can never find out any information on him, which makes him all the more terrifying. Why is he picking this town? Why is he picking these people? Like, we know why he's picking these people, these types of people, but why these people in this city? Why? And I think that's what's interesting. There is no motive. There is no behind the scenes. Like, we're not getting why he chose here. We just know that he's choosing some these people because of whatever disgust he has with these people. And, you know, his performance is great, but that takes a lot of guts from a director, from a studio, from a writer. I mean, Andrew Kevin Walker, who wrote this script, pretty much did nothing else of worth. I mean, he did Sleepy Hollow, which is pretty good. But before this, he had done movies Brain Scan and Hideaway. That was it. And then he does Seven. And for them to take this on with David Fincher, who had only done Alien 3 and a bunch of music videos, hadn't done anything else, to direct that, get that director with an unknown writer and allow them to say, you know what? We're just going to take a chance and we're going to have the killer be this person who's not even going to be on screen, not even going to be in the credits, nothing like that. That is an incredibly, incredibly difficult thing to pull off. And it's, you know, it's never been duplicated. And I think that's another thing that's nice about this movie is it really can't be replicated. So many other movies, they try to replicate them or they can or whatever it is. You can't replicate this movie.
No, there are too many aspects of it that are just so unique to it. It's like, it happened at the perfect time where we could have the Somerset and Mills character. And because we've already had Seven, because Seven's happened, you can never just have the murderer walk right up into the precinct again, like declare he's the murderer when you had no idea who he was. It just doesn't work anymore. And Seven kind of ruined noir films for that because it didn't give them that option. But at the same time, it also just rewrote the rules for how noirs could function.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the fact that Fincher then goes on to do The Game 2 years later and then Fight Club 2 years after that and then Panic Room and really start to build up this name for himself, that also elevates it. I mean, this, like you said, this is kind of like a teenage boy movie. Like if you're 14, 15 years old, you're in high school, you're getting into movies, whatever it is, this is going to be one of those movies where people say, yo, did you see Seven yet? You got to watch that movie. And look how much this inspired like the Saw franchise. And James Wan and different directors like that, like this movie essentially does what the Saw franchise attempts to do. And I think the first one does very well, but it's so much better of a way because it gives a real purpose to a lot of what's going on. And it asks so many deeper questions and sets it in so much more of a reality. It's very interesting to see how this movie, you know, blossomed in other things. And then also, like you said, like this isn't as dark of a movie as you think. Fight Club is a darker movie. But that became Fincher's calling card. People don't really talk about The Game, but they talk about Fight Club and they talk about Seven, which are two movies that have very similar visual style. And they both have Brad Pitt and, you know, like, you know, these two kind of like characters butting heads throughout and grimy and gritty and all that fun stuff. It's, I don't know. It's just, it's interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, throughout it, we also get these like tidbits, like, well, my favorite line from this entire film is, if he's not the devil, he's just a man. Mm-hmm. Like, when Somerset says that to Mills, it's actually one of the most frightening things in this entire movie. Because it's that idea that these crimes seem so absurd that a man could never commit them. And then, of course, everything's confirmed when we finally do meet John Doe. That he's just a man. Yeah, he's atypical in his way of thought, but like he's just a man. It's not like it's the devil incarnate, right? Like, and that I think is another thing that Fincher does really well is he kind of leaves it open for a supernatural element if he so chooses. And then what makes it even better is that he doesn't go that way. Yeah. And like it is just the terror of man.
Yeah. It's just this unknown guy who has no background at all but is smarter than all of them. And he's running them in circles and he's messing with them the entire time.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Lecter archetype that we talked about last week, right? Where it's a smart, intelligent villain who, if you didn't see him in the setting, you'd probably not think anything of him.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. And I think that's what makes it also scary is it's like, this could kind of be anybody. Just kind of like a normal looking guy who, you know, you start wondering, like, who else is doing this? And I love when they talk about, like, you know how much discipline it takes to torture somebody for a year, keep them alive for a year while they're in that bed and change things out and get the antibiotics. You know how much discipline that takes? Like,
and like the conversation with, like, the landlord of how he was the perfect tenant. You know, neighbors never complained, paid the rent on time. And it's just, like, it really makes you think about, like, what aren't you seeing that's happening around you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know, in a city, you know, like you look at like some of those, what is the sloth one is taking place above, what is it, like a bar or a strip club or something? Like it's, you know, that apartment is above some sort of normal building that you would see in a city. And it's just been there the whole time. And the air fresheners just kept it all hidden so that nobody would ever know.
Yeah. It's fascinating what he does. And then we haven't even talked about the performances in this movie.
Yeah.
Where like Brad Pitt gives an incredible performance at the beginning of his career. And the way he portrays Mills, you're not even surprised at the end when he becomes Rat, because Fincher and Pitt just build up to it the entire time. We see the frustration in Mills. We see that he's trying to prove himself, and he's eager to prove himself, but we also see that he's very quick-tempered and he's willing to break the rules a little bit to get there. So when we do finally get to him shooting John Doe at the end, we're not even surprised, because it's exactly as the character was built up through the last 2 hours.
Yep. No, it's really well done. And Brad Pitt plays it perfectly, where he does have a temper and he does get annoyed by things. And, you know, he is a little too gung-ho, and he's young and he's not as methodical. He hasn't been broken by the system the way that Somerset has. And Morgan Freeman wins the Oscar for Million Dollar Baby, and I think that's his best performance. And Shawshank, he's obviously great in too. But this is up there with one of his best. I mean, he really carries this movie. He plays that, like, very quiet person so well. And his line of John Doe has the upper hand, that panic in his voice and the way he changes everything. It's the first time we really actually see emotion from Somerset in this movie. Even when he's talking to Gwyneth Paltrow about her having the baby and he's giving her the advice, it still feels so calculated and detective-y, and like I'm interrogating you. And when he says John Doe has the upper hand, that look on Morgan Freeman's face, you're like, he's got the upper hand. Like, it's just so well done. Yeah, the performances are great. Also, like, this was kind of before a lot of them had become big, you know. Obviously, Thelma and Louise had come out by then. Shawshank, Morgan Freeman's coming on the heels of Shawshank, which is why he gets the lead role probably in this. Gwyneth Paltrow really hadn't done anything yet. Shakespeare in Love was going to be 3 years later, which would kind of really put her on the map. As I said, Kevin Spacey, it was this year that he did the usual suspects. So it wasn't like he was incredibly well known yet. A lot of chances taken. I mean, really, you could argue, other than Morgan Freeman, because he was in The Shawshank Redemption, when they started casting this movie without knowing what Shawshank was going to become, Arlie Ermey might have been the most recognizable person in the movie, because at least he was in Full Metal Jacket and he'd been nominated for an Oscar for it.
Yeah. So, yeah. It was kind of like this. It's one of those like perfect situations, right? Where it's just like everything turned out really well in the end, and it's this just launching point for a lot of people's careers.
And yeah, like, and I didn't.
David Fincher bounces back from Alien 3, and like Brad Pitt shows that he has these serious chops.
Yeah, and I mean, like, and Morgan Freeman, it wasn't like Morgan Freeman was just hit or miss. That was the biggest. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest problem for Morgan Freeman. Like, when you look at his career, obviously, like, he didn't really do much, and then all of a sudden he just like came onto the scene. And when he comes onto the scene and like really gets his first big break, it's in Driving Miss Daisy, which wins the Oscar, comes in the same year as Glory. So in 1989, like all of a sudden it's like, okay, Morgan Freeman's really on the map here. He does Unforgiven 3 years later, which is a Clint Eastwood movie. So that's going to put him on the map. But then in between Unforgiven and like he goes Unforgiven, then he has like 2 year break, Shawshank, Seven. And then he's just kind of like all over the place. I don't know. Like Morgan Freeman to me, I wonder what people would normally say if you were to sit down with somebody and say, what do you know Morgan Freeman from best? Like, what's the first movie that comes to mind when you think of Morgan Freeman? Because by me making the statement of he wasn't that big yet, a lot of people are going to go, you're an idiot. Driving Miss Daisy, Unforgiven, Shawshank Redemption, all that. But what are the movies that people really think of Morgan Freeman for? I don't think it's those movies. Shawshank, yes, but I don't think it's Unforgiven, and I don't think it's Driving Miss Daisy. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that those are definitely a little bit more niche at this point.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's more his roles like in the early 2000s that people associate him with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Bruce Almighty, where he's God. Batman Begins, like when he starts getting into those movies. Like, I kind of agree. I mean, I just feel like that's where he starts to come in a little bit more. But, you know, again, he's just a little hit or miss. I don't know. And then he also did, he did Kiss the Girls on the heels of this, which is like the bad version of Seven. Yeah. So I don't know. Anyway, definitely a movie where chances were taken. Morgan Freeman, I'm sure. Also, even if you, even if you're going to say, yeah, okay, well, Morgan Freeman was big at this time, not in a role like this. He never really had the lead role. Driving Miss Daisy, I don't care what anybody says, it's a bad movie. And I don't think people were like clamoring for more Morgan Freeman after that movie, even if it did win Best Picture. Unforgiven, he's not the lead role in Unforgiven. It's Clint Eastwood.
Not by
any. He's definitely the sidekick. And Gene Hackman's there. So he's like definitely the sidekick. But for him to carry a movie like this and still just be Morgan Freeman, it's really, really, really well done. So
yeah, especially because like Somerset's just in that role that's like, it's like a Humphrey Bogart role, essentially, that Morgan Freeman is taking on. And it's just, it really shows his range in comparison to some of those other movies where he does kind of take the backseat instead.
Mm-hmm. I will say that I have completely dived. I have completely jumped headfirst into what is Kevin Spacey up to now. I won't lie. That has been going on while we've been over here. And he has two movies that are in post-production, which is very, very shocking to me, considering all of the things that seem to be more than allegations at this point. But yeah, two movies that are supposed to be coming out this year with him in them. And there's another movie about Gore Vidal, which he's in, and with Michael Stuhlbarg. So I'm confused. Anyway, we'll see how that goes. We'll see if those movies actually come out. John is gone. He has completely vanished. I think his device is just disconnected. So I don't know what's going on with that. Maybe it's because I said Kevin Spacey and he just got kicked off the interwebs. John, I was just continuing to talk about Kevin Spacey.
No, I mean, maybe that's what it was. I think
that's all it was. I am curious to see if these movies actually ever get put out anywhere or if they're just made and that's it. I'm very shocked that Michael Stuhlbarg's in a movie with Kevin Spacey. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Next week, we are going to be going into our number 49s. We're going to be going back to James Bond for John with You Only Live Twice from 1967. And for me, we're going Double Indemnity, going back to Billy Wilder, 1944, two very fun movies from the olden days. So that should be a good one. Should be a good podcast. On February 8th, they're going to be announcing the Oscar nominations. So John and I will be getting on that Patreon content after that. I might make a separate tier, just like a $6 tier so that people like only get what they actually want. So you guys aren't getting crammed with content from other stuff that you don't care about. Or I would say just go become $5 patrons. And that's where I'm going to end up throwing it anyway. It's just a lot of Survivor people are going to end up getting this stuff. But we'll be doing at least one episode for all 10 of the Best Picture nominees this year. Hopefully they're good ones because I think I've watched probably about two that are going to get nominated. So that'll be fun. So that should be coming. We'll be starting that stuff pretty soon. And we'll be back probably next week, like middle of the week again, as we tend to be. But thank you all for listening. Thank you for helping us get over halfway through this thing. Much appreciated. And we'll see you next time with Double Indemnity and You Only Live Twice.